The thing about self-managing is it should have an asterisk, because what it really means is you're empowered. You're not really self-managing. You have accountability. You're not just accountable to yourself. You have accountability, and there usually is assigned leadership. You're given a problem to solve, and you're given a lot of latitude. It's not open-ended. You're given a lot of latitude, and you're expected to align with other people. You're not allowed to like go your own way and step on other products or go against corporate strategy. You're expected, as you operate, to reach out and to collaborate and to figure out how to keep things aligned. This meme in the Agile community of, oh, just create a bunch of people and then get out of the way. This is frankly nonsense. Experienced leaders who hear that, it really diminishes the credibility of what the Agile community has to say.
Hello, hello everybody, and welcome back to the Boundaryless Conversations podcast. On this podcast, we meet with pioneers, with thinkers and doers, and we talk about the future of business models, organizations, markets, and society in this rapidly changing world. Today, I'm joined by my usual co-host, Shruti. Hello, Shruti.
Hi, everyone.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we are excited because today we are joined by Cliff Berg, co-founder and managing partner at the Agile 2 Academy and a leading figure in Agile and DevOps advising worldwide. Cliff is the lead author also of Agile 2, the next iteration of Agile, bringing a very fresh perspective on Agile methodologies. Cliff has an extensive experience as an executive leader advisor. Cliff has also helped shape the agile practices of many organizations worldwide. And today, he will share insights into the evolution of agile, especially in where it's headed, a topic where I intuitively believe that we share a lot of common ground. Cliff, it's very great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Simone and Shruti. It's a pleasure.
As an opening question, I would like to ask you to maybe share a little bit of a background story of what was your experience in midwifing the Agile 2 thesis into life. Because for those of you of listeners which follow your work, you know, this idea of Agile 2 has some level of discontinuity with how we normally identify Agile as a topic in organizational development and design and software development. So I leave it to you to tell us a bit more about how this idea came up together with your fellow writers and doers.
You know, when the Agile Manifesto came out in 2000, I was CTO of a company called Digital Focus, and we had about 200 people. And about somewhere in 2000, one of my project managers came to me and said, our team wants to start using extreme programming. Extreme programming was really a hot topic at that time. Everybody was talking, IT was talking about extreme programming. What is that? And it sounds so cool and so on. And so I respected those people. I trusted them, this project manager and the team lead in that team. And I said, try it. And it worked out really well. And so we adopted it across the company. My company became a major sponsor of the annual Agile conference after the Agile Manifesto came out and the Agile Alliance was formed. But then I watched in horror over the years because at the Agile Manifesto created the Agile movement, which kind of supplanted, kind of took the mantle from extreme programming. You know, before the Agile Manifesto, it was XP, XP. And all of a sudden, it was Agile, Agile. And interestingly, they don't align well, you know, because XP is extreme by intent, whereas the Agile Manifesto is very much about balance, not extreme. But no one kind of noticed that discontinuity. So anyway, but it's all good. There are different ideas. But then as the Agile movement kind of started to gain steam and be used at scale in companies, things didn't work out kind of that well. And then, you know, you started to see a proliferation within the what became the Agile community of like different focuses. And the Agile movement became very much about human and behavioral process things, which are all really important. In fact, it's kind of the most important thing, but started to ignore the whole technical side. And so that kind of bifurcated the movement. As a result, DevOps became its own thing instead of part of the Agile movement, even though early proponents of CI/CD identified as Agilists. So much dysfunction grew out of those times. You started to see, you know, from very early on, these frameworks, you know, starting with Scrum Master certification, really created a very bad trend. In fact, in 10 years after the manifesto, the British Computer Society did a study of the state of Agile, and they basically listed all these dysfunctions. And when the pandemic started a few years ago, it then was 20 years in, those same dysfunctions were still in place. In fact, they were more deeply embedded. And so I thought, this sucks. We have to do something. And I had been for years working with companies to help them improve their DevOps approach. My last engagement before the pandemic was I helped the senior vice president of operations to devise a DevOps strategy at a large fintech company. When the pandemic started, we all kind of had to rethink what we were doing. And I thought, you know, this might be a good time because right now people are in the mindset of rethinking. We had to rethink how we work. So why not rethink all about how we work? And so I put a team together. I reached out to a colleague and we created a list of the capabilities needed by the team. So it wasn't a random list. We needed someone who had deep product design experience, but in an agile way. And I don't mean agile like framework. I mean agile in terms of, so actually his experience was from Google. And someone who had deep program management experience, but with a very fast moving agile flavor. We also human resources, but with an agile flavor. We ended up someone who has a founder of an agile PeopleOps framework. And so on. So we created this table and system engineering because, you know, a lot of software is used in products, in real products like Bosch and companies like that. So we put this team together, ended up having 15 people. And then this effort spanned like 6 months. It wasn't a weekend. And we started with a retrospective on what's working and what's not working. What do we think? You know, and we created a list of more than 100 what we called key ideas. If more than one person, if at least two people identified the same issue, it made the list. And then we reviewed that list and we distilled out from that a set of what I regret that we use this term. We called them principles. And really, they should be called reminders because there are no principles. This is about human behavior. There are no principles. The only principle is it always depends. But anyway, we called them principles for better or worse. They're really like reminders. And there were 43 of them. We tried to get a smaller list, but we couldn't, you know, because we realized that if you distilled it down below that, it would lose its meaning. It would become very intangible. And so we kept it what it was, what it naturally was. And it was 43 things. We published that in October of that year as Agile 2. And then we undertook a crash program to write a book about it, which Wiley published. I wanted it to be 200 pages. It ended up being 400 pages. And we wrote and went through like 10 revisions and reviews with everybody. Well, the seven people who volunteered to work on the book out of the 15. And the whole process, including 9 rounds of revision with Wiley and go to print. It was for sale after 4 months, the 400-page book, end to end.
Very agile.
Could not be done. I said, watch us. It was the chronic dysfunction. And we say very clearly, we're not trying to replace. We're trying to help align, help pivot and help improve and shore up the Agile movement, because I write a lot about today about the Agile movement's in decline, because it is. But We were trying to prevent that. If the movement's in decline, it's what that means is it doesn't mean Agile doesn't matter. It absolutely does. It matters more than ever. The ideas are not in decline. It's just AI has now taken the place in terms of things that are top of mind for decision makers and fast-moving high-tech organizations. Once a movement kind of loses mind share, it tends not to come back. You know, like you look at Lean Six Sigma and what happened with that. It disappeared almost overnight. But the ideas are still around. In fact, the ideas are embedded in how a lot of people think. So the ideas don't go away. But, you know, the movement might lose its share of the space in the talk sphere. But it still matters.
It's 43 reminders, but maybe you can give us a little overview of what are the key diseases of Agile that emerged from the retrospective that you did. I'm less interested in the key positive things, because everybody knows that about Agile. So, but many times we forget that there are some issues maybe that could be both ingrained in the very idea from the very start, or maybe just things that diseases that we acquired as a movement over the years. So what are these major problems that you have identified, at least groups of topics that maybe you can give us an overview so that we can, you know, kind of piggyback on that, on those?
I mean, where to begin?
Yes.
Recently, I wrote a post that unexpectedly went viral. It was like a random post I made on a Friday night. I didn't expect anyone to see it. And it ended up getting like almost 2 million views. It was basically Agile rest in peace, in terms of Agile movement, you know, not Agile ideas. In response to that, you know, there were 700 comments. There were 700 comments that people posted. And so we went through those and tabulated them. We categorized them by what is this person trying to say? And which was not easy. That was a lot of work. We put them in categories. I think there were 19 categories or something. And the top one that people mentioned, which was exactly what we found in the Agile 2 work, the same exact, it aligned perfectly. And the top one was, it's all about leadership. And yet that's the singular big glaring hole in the Agile manifesto. It says nothing about leadership. In fact, it hints, it very subtly kind of diminishes and dismisses the importance of leadership, you know, self-organizing team, which has a hint of a really good idea, but it's not expressed right. And trust the team to get the job done, which is a good thing, but it's more about what it doesn't say. Yeah, trust the team, but all the time? Absolutely. Is that an absolute? People often forget that when you have a self-organizing team, someone created the team. Someone decided who was going to be on the team. And someone decided if they were up to the task of being self-organizing. Being self-organizing and having that go well usually requires, number one, you have a very generative, constructive culture, because teams are not an island. They depend on the organization. And it also requires that the people in the team generally have a fairly high EQ. They're not petty, and they're not, you know, thinking mostly about what they want to do. And self-organization, I think of our homeowner association, which is self-organizing, and it's a snake pit. The kernel good idea is that you want to empower people, is what they should have said, but with judgment. It's all about leadership. And when the Agile community, which likes to go to extremes, and I blame XP for that, they think self-organization, oh, it has to be absolutely self-organizing, which means no assigned leader. Mm-hmm. Well, usually you do need an assigned leader, but what kind? Again, the Agile community has these memes within it, and one of them is the pointy-haired boss, and they equate managers with the pointy-haired boss. Well, there are a lot of really effective, Agile, powerful companies that do amazing things that have lots of managers, and a lot of them are really good. An effective manager is a good leader. Just dismissing, oh, you don't need managers, is nonsense. You absolutely do. It's managers who have authority, who can put things in motion and commit resources and bring the people in, and also mentor people and generate the inspiration and be a servant leader, but also be other kinds of leader. There are many kinds of leadership that are needed to make a complex endeavor work. It usually is not, it's not one person. It's the kinds of leadership. We actually, in the course that we have, there's a list of types of leadership that tend to be really important in complex initiatives. If you have the right kinds of leadership, it doesn't matter what framework you have. In fact, you're better off without any framework. If you have a framework and bad leadership or insufficient leadership, you'll still fail.
Mm-hmm.
The framework is irrelevant at best, and at worst, it's in the way.
How do you sort of propagate this further, right? Like now that we have, let's say, Agile 2.0, where let's say leadership is a point that you mentioned, how do you get that buy-in? And more so when businesses are becoming more and more complex, organizations are either way in sort of this constant flux of balancing hierarchy versus attaining flatness in the organization. So how do you, like you said, that you Agile 2.0 works better with complex organizations. So just to touch upon that a bit more.
Another kind of meme in the Agile community is, and it sounds like I'm dumping on the Agile, which I do a lot because you have to make change. Agility is important. That's why I dump on it, to get people to rethink stuff. One of the memes is that hierarchy is bad. It can be. It absolutely can be. The thing is, you need structure. And a lot of organizations have too much hierarchy. They have too much structure. But the real issue is how people behave. Because if there's a culture where you're allowed and expected to work with other areas and reach across structure, then the structure doesn't matter. What's toxic is if the structure is used as domains of control and domains. In order to talk to other people, you have to go up the chain, and where the different parts of the structure compete because of the way funding is allocated or incentives are designed. The structure can be very toxic, but it really is rooted in how the behavior operates of the people at the top levels and how that structure is used. Because structure can enables you to mobilize people very quickly. You can tell all your people, okay, start working on this. All of a sudden, we need to do this. And so structure can make you very agile. That's why the military uses structure, because they can immediately say, all these people, go over there. So structure is not inherently bad. It's whether or not the structure becomes a prison and a set of barriers is really the issue. But that said, hierarchical structure tends to be a little bit too rigid today. And what seems to work better today with, you mentioned optionality, is to create structure as you need it, instead of having this permanent structure. And that has to do with Amazon has a single-threaded team concept and mobilizing people in groups to solve a particular problem. But by doing that, you're creating a structure. It's just not a hierarchical structure.
I love this idea that you said structure can make you very agile, because that's what it is. A few months ago, there was a big conversation around Airbnb's CEO, Brian Chesky, coming up and saying, we cut a lot of distributed teams and we centralize a lot of editorial control on things. So there was like a bit of a backlash. But at the end of the day, he needed the structure to make the organization work better and deliver better value to his customers. So sometimes I feel like when we speak about self-managing organizations, we tend to speak about means instead of ends. And so what's the point of being self-managing if we're not serving our customers well? But on the other side, there is some kind of impact that adopting a self-managing structure generates on the outcomes that the organization creates. For example, the more self-managing is the organization, the less coherent is the outcome of the organization, right? So that's kind of an equation that you cannot really force out. Given that you are saying we need structure, even if it's not a hierarchy that we need, but we need some structure. We need a way, for example, to ensure that the right leadership shows up at the right time. What is the problem with frameworks? For example, if let's take SAFe, okay, which is the framework that everybody blames most of the times. I feel sometimes it's very silly, that the blaming of SAFe for the sake of blaming it, because it's kind of provides some affordances to solving some coordination problems or capital allocation with the portfolio staff and so on. So really, what is the problem with frameworks, and how do you make the conversation we had so far more relevant and actionable for companies? So besides saying the old way doesn't work, what do we do then if not frameworks?
Well, frameworks on the Agile 2 actually mentions this. I'm a longtime colleague of Scott Ambler. He created a major framework called Disciplined Agile, but his viewpoint is these frameworks are a source of ideas, just implement. And frameworks have a lot of great patterns in them. I love SAFe's portfolio Kanban idea, but it's just an idea. It's just an idea. You shouldn't implement that. You should take the idea and then think, what should I do? If you give people a framework that, like, give it to them and say, here, do this, you create what psychologists call functional fixedness, where they stop thinking and they go through the motions. It becomes pro forma. You mentioned that you use lots of questions when you work with clients. That's the right way to start. Start with questions. How are we going to make this happen? How are we going to make sure that our culture evolves the way we want it to? How are we going to make sure that our stuff actually works and continues to work, but without slowing us down? How are we going to do that? And ideate on that. And that's where you bring in the patterns and the frameworks that you've seen for ideas. But then you come up with your own approach. The worst thing you can do is give someone a framework and say, do this. That basically kills their innovation, kills their thinking, and turns it into just do these tasks and then go home. You want a more generative approach where you challenge people to solve problems, and frameworks are a great source of ideas and patterns, but you should never implement them as stated.
When you think about, don't apply frameworks just for the sake of applying them, okay? Which is very resonant to the idea of, again, saying self-managing organization just because we want to be self-managing. We don't care about the ends or the outcomes. Seems a similar conversation for me, right? The point is, an organization will never be successful because it applied frameworks. It will be successful judging on the outcomes it generates on the customers. So the big word, let's say, that for me, it's on the table, it's accountability, right? So to what are these teams accountable for? In some of the things that we have seen as promising in terms of new ways of organizing, we are seeing a lot of much bigger role for capital allocation, venture building, and entrepreneurial skin in the game. So imagine that teams can have their self-managing capabilities, but normally there is a balance on bearing the consequences of the choices that they make in terms of, for example, consuming certain funding that lets them do what they want, or failing to create equity value for them, or something like that. So if we want to measure avenues of overcoming the traditional problems that we have with Agile, for example, we can start from accountability. You can maybe explore a bit of what you are seeing in terms of these and other avenues that that you would suggest.
Oh boy, where to start? I mean, I was in a meeting with, I guess their VPs, about 2 weeks ago, in the engineering group of a client. I was chatting with one of them before the meeting. He gave me a list of things that he wants to achieve because we're working with them to create a developmental program around. They have a group manager level. We're helping them upskill those people. And the top thing he led off with was basically accountability. He was complaining that they don't feel accountable for commitments. That's a complex issue because organizations often overdo commitments. Commitment should be something that's really important. You make a promise to a customer or something. That's a commitment. If you make everything a commitment, your people will burn out. I've talked a lot with Bjarte Bogsnes, who leads the Beyond Budgeting Roundtable. And a core concept there is to differentiate strongly between commitments and aspirational goals. And then the third thing is how much you allocate to that, you know, your budget. So aspirational goals are commitments, and commitments are very different things. You should be very parsimonious about what you commit. But if you make a commitment, you should take it very seriously. And he complained that his people don't. I think this is another meme in the Agile community. And I think the term self-managing team, I understand the intent, but the term bothers me because I know how it's read, and a lot of people in the Agile community hear a term and they make assumptions and they don't read further. They think now they read the term, they know all about it. Most teams are not self-managing. And if you look at the most Agile and successful companies, and we look very closely at five, we looked at SpaceX. And by the way, I'm not an Elon Musk fan. SpaceX, you know, he created an amazingly innovative culture at SpaceX, but that's where our interest ends. But the companies we looked at were SpaceX, Amazon, Netflix, Spotify, and Google. And they all shared very similar things. And they are not about self-managing teams. They are about leadership and very specific kinds of leadership behaviors. And, you know, those leadership behaviors are very much about giving people problems to solve and then letting them figure out how to solve it. That's self-managing to a large degree, but it's not an absolute. I mentioned Amazon's single-threaded leadership model, and you could call those self-managing teams, but it's not like they have no accountability. They absolutely do. Always someone in charge of single-threaded leadership team. It's not like, oh, there's a bunch of people and they self-organize. They don't self-organize. And a single-threaded team has to, I hate to say report, but that's how they do it. I wouldn't do it that way, but that's how they do it. It works for them. Their self-managing teams have to report to senior managers about how they're doing. And they have a very specific process for how that reporting is done. The thing about self-managing is it should have an asterisk, because what it really means is you're empowered. You're not really self-managing. You have accountability. You're not just accountable to yourself. You have accountability, and there usually is assigned leadership. You're given a problem to solve, and you're given a lot of latitude. It's not open-ended. You're given a lot of latitude, and you're expected to align with other people. You're not allowed to like go your own way and step on other products or go against corporate strategy. You're expected, as you operate, to reach out and to collaborate and to figure out how to keep things aligned. This meme in the Agile community of, oh, just create a bunch of people and then get out of the way. This is frankly nonsense. Experienced leaders who hear that, it really diminishes the credibility of what the Agile community has to say, because they know that that's not how things work. The effective leaders in these very effective, highly Agile companies are very involved. They're not getting out of the way. They're very involved, and they ask a lot of questions. They give a lot of agency and autonomy, but they're not stepping back and trusting. They're watching.
It looks like to me that when you say we need this accountability in the system, and it can be either accountability to a leader that has been empowered to lead, to some extent he should really bear the consequences of his leadership, or there should be another type of accountability that maybe in more advanced organizations it's an accountability to managing your own resources, for which you still need some internal kind of expression of leadership likely into a team, no? That needs to manage its own resources that are finite and need to be replenished either with selling services to the customer or negotiating other budgets. And I think this is interesting, you know, to underline for our listeners that there needs to be this accountability in teams. It can be either some accountability that is given from a leadership perspective, a design, an editorial leadership, like, for example, in Airbnb or other type of things, or it needs to be an accountability to how do you collect capital. So, for example, in Hire, we see a lot of these contracts where the strategic leadership invests money into teams and they need to manage their own P&L. And then you have accountability to the money that you receive. And finally, I wanted to underline another interesting thing that you said that really struck a chord with me when you said you have to be parsimonious on what do you commit to. When we speak about organizations that develop a lot of optionality, in the past, we encountered the promise theory from Mark Burgess, where you tend to describe the system as a chain of promises that you make to each other. Developing complex systems really encourages teams to don't depend too much on promises the others make to you. And so if you have a really adaptable system, first of all, you need to avoid depending on too many promises and try not to make too many promises to others, right? And this keeps the system very adaptable and keeps the optionality into the system, which I think is really important for organizations that live in the 21st century. Hey, you are listening to this episode on an audio-only version. Get the best of the experience by watching these and other episodes in video on YouTube. Go to YouTube and search for Boundless Conversations, or just take your browser and write bls.io/bcpy, all capital letters, and you'll get there. On YouTube, you'll be able to subscribe to our channel and get notifications when new episodes are released.
There were a few strings that stood out. So one being, let's say, leadership being a problem factor in Agile 1.0, and then now, let's say, the development of the next step. And I was also remembering the previous podcast that we had with open system theory practitioners and how they mentioned that essentially, you know, when a company puts out an ad, they are looking for a person who is going to fit into a certain role, which is, you know, within a fixed mold that has already been described for them, versus hiring a person to solve a problem. So with what you have said about the role that leadership plays as well, right? So how do you think that the leaders can give people problems to solve rather than tasks to complete, essentially, and therefore sort of dive much deeper into a more holistic transformation and a mindset sort of shift across the organization?
So I heard three things between the two of you, and so I'll take them in reverse order. This is behavioral. Almost all of this is behavioral, and that's why frameworks don't matter. It's all about how people in positions of influence or authority respond in situations. That includes like thinking in terms of like, do I defining job roles or looking for someone to solve a problem? And when you bring in someone new, do you just look, do they check the boxes on what we're currently doing? Or do I think they're able to solve hard problems? And then using the people you have, giving them problems to solve, and then paying attention and participating so that they don't fall off a cliff. But I think that's mostly behavioral at all levels of the organization. There's HR behavior, there's leadership behavior that impacts that. And predefining roles in terms of roles are very situational, and people tend to make their own role. So if you over-define a role, you're really kind of creating an impossible situation. You won't find someone who really fits the role. That doesn't mean you shouldn't define roles. Again, it's not an absolute. Let's not be extreme about this stuff. The other things I heard were about promises and also like the idea of people having their own incentives, like a P&L or their own kind of like mini business and accountability. And about promises, I think that makes me think of in the course that we developed, we teach three paradigms in terms of how you your relationship to another group. And they might be a third party that like you bump up against here and there, but you're not really interacting with them intentionally. It's like, imagine you're building a building, but then there's someone else building another building and you share a street and they need to close the street one afternoon, but you have cement trucks coming in. So they're not involved in your project, but you need to coordinate with them, or you need to be transparent with them about what you plan to be doing because you affect them. And then another kind of relationship is a contract relationship where they're a supplier. Now, that often is very effective when you're buying commodity things. Like, I need to find someone to deliver salt. And you don't care who it is because you don't care one kind of salt or another. Or maybe you do. Maybe it depends if you're eating it or putting it on your road, I guess. But you want a commodity and it's all the same. You just want the cheapest one and you find the best supplier who's reliable, no cost, and so on. And then a third type is partnership. And, you know, there's usually a contract with a partner, but it needs to be very flexible. If you make the promise more about what they're going to do versus about the relationship, you can make it overly rigid. Because in the development of a product, it evolves and the interface tends to evolve. So interfaces are very important for agility, actually. It's like an API, but it needs to be able to evolve in a coordinated way. You need to be thinking about how are we going to collaborate about changing the promise, like easily, not with a lot of overhead. That needs to be part of the relationship, how we work together to keep changing these interfaces. If you're a partner, you both have skin in the game. In our study of SpaceX, I ended up meeting someone named Dan Rasky, who founded the commercial NASA's space portal. It's basically their office that was set up. He co-founded that office as a bridge for space startups like SpaceX. And now the so many others that have sprouted up. The idea was to make, instead of making NASA looking for suppliers, which is what they used to do, and they still do it, they basically, you know, create a requirements list and they ask for bids on this, and that they getting suppliers. The space portal was about creating partnerships. And with the partnership, everyone has skin in the game. The vendor invests their own money to build something, and they only get paid if it works. But then they own the product. They own to deliver it as like, you paid for it, it's yours. They own the intellectual property, the vendor owns it. And so there's an incentive. They now can productize what NASA got them to develop. That partnership is very important. With regard to groups within a company that have like their own P&L, they're not autonomous. They're partly autonomous. That's my problem with the word self-managing, but also autonomous and self-work. These are not absolutes. They're autonomous in the sense that they have a lot of latitude and agency, but they're not entirely autonomous. They have to align with corporate strategy. They have to ask for resources. They have to fit into the larger picture. So the autonomy is a matter of degree, and someone's watching, and someone's deciding what they can have autonomy about from week to week. It's not unlimited. It's being managed. The level of autonomy and degrees of freedom are being managed by someone.
I think you said, again, a couple of important things that are worth highlighting when you said, with the example of the NASA portal, and when you spoke about the importance to be elastic in changing promises, right? A lot of what we are seeing in terms of organizational innovation for the most performing companies we are seeing these days is coming in from two spaces, let's say, right? One space is platforms and ecosystems. So a lot of companies that have their third parties, developer portals, for example, in the podcast we had Scott Brinker speaking about HubSpot strategy and how HubSpot is leveraging on so many third parties, and they co-develop shared experiences by integrating different applications at different levels. And this is really an epitome of how you partner with larger ecosystems. They can distribute your products, integrate your products. So lots of the thriving organizations of the 21st century have this interface-based partnership making, continuous partnership making, which is one big direction of innovation we are seeing in terms of when we think about an organizational product and so on. And another one that we are lucky at Boundless to be at the very center of is this approach based on distributing P&L, but not only, but also the capability to contracting and to do contracting and to reach the market. So in the practice that we praise, let's say, it's not just distributing P&L for the sake of controlling TCO of things, but it's rather you kind of become, as a P&L owner, you become free to negotiate and contract and buy and sell. And a lot of these interactions between nodes happens according to what you said, bids, opening requests and then receiving bids and choosing what you want to partner with, which for me integrates a lot the perspective that we discussed before, that of course you can have a promise from someone, right? But the fact that somebody is promising you to do something in a contract, it doesn't mean they are going to actually do that. They may fail in doing it. And therefore, you need to develop optionality, different options and different avenues to the resources you need and so on. Which for me, it's really, to some extent, it's really acknowledging that we are living in complexity. And therefore, if we look at the industrial age and we look at the hierarchies that we have used to manage organization in the industrial age, bureaucratically, those really don't need any leadership. There is a very limited amount of leadership that you need. Instead, for organizations that have to thrive in complexity, that people are used to think of, this is needs to be self-managing, so we don't need leaders. It's actually the opposite. You need much more leaders, many more leaders in a distributed and complex organization than you need in a hierarchical industrial organization. What do you think?
Yeah, it depends what your goal is. It depends whoever owns the ecosystem, what's their goal. One of our clients is a medical research foundation that was launched about almost 2 years ago, and we helped them develop their core strategies for how to move quickly and be nimble. They have an external-facing scientific advisory committee, and they also have an internal, what they had been calling a council. But the internal one is basically principal investigators from across that university. One approach, which is very kind of hands-off, is just ask the principal investigator, how can we help you? And how can we help you with the grant proposals you're writing and bring people together and treat it as an ecosystem? Another approach is to be a mission-driven organization, which they are, and to use that council to ideate on what are some big problems in medical research that we think we're in a good position to solve. And that becomes much more proactive. So instead of then treating it as an ecosystem, you try to align people and you try to create opportunities. So you try to get funding and then that you get big blocks of funding so they don't have to all go find their own grants. And you give them the funding to do things that are all going to push this thread forward to solve a big problem. What they actually are doing is a combination of the two. Again, it's not one or the other, doing a combination, but they are very mission driven. And because they're mission driven, they don't want it to be just an ecosystem. They want there to be a lot of alignment in terms of what all the different research teams are doing.
That's very resonating with the idea that the more vertically integrated is the purpose and the mission, the more you have to exert some type of control in the organizational structure and be a bit more top-down, while if you really embrace a more distributed optionality-based approach, you also have to accept that things that can emerge are not necessarily aligned 100% with your mission or purpose. So I think you made a great point.
That's very key because in my experience, extremes don't usually work well, except in very extreme situations. And the challenge for the director of this institute is finding the right balance between those two, because what you just said is actually very key. You can't anticipate what people are going to discover and what ideas they're going to have. And so if you lock things down, we're all going to go in this direction. You basically shut down everybody's, you basically foreclose on the, that's others might come up with ideas that you haven't thought of, discoveries that might completely change the game. You have to have a mix. And finding that right mix is the challenge. The wrong answer, it's all one or all the other. There's a right mix most of the time. And finding that mix is the judgment call that is the main challenge.
For me, it's always been about let's say even with my previous roles, when we do take up transformation practices, it sort of dies out post, let's say, one implementation quite often. I'm not saying all the time, but quite often. So how do you, let's say, ensure that these practices have sustainability in them? How do you ensure it's sticky as a practice and it basically runs its course rather than being like a one-time sort of implementation activity?
A lot of people in leadership roles in the IT field, during the period of Y2K, around that time, a lot of them had Y2K programs that worked, and they learned that approach. And also the whole area of data management and getting control of your data was very prominent during the early 2000s. And a lot of managers learned from that experience. And they basically learned that what worked was what like Accenture and those companies do. They come in and help you create a big program plan, and then you roll that out, and then you're done. And they learned that paradigm. And that paradigm does not work for this, because this is very behavioral. Actually, there are some parallels with data management, because there's behavior there too, but not to the same degree. Agility is almost entirely behavioral, and the behaviors that really matter are not the individual contributors, it's the leaders, the people in roles that have any kind of authority. And so really, it's mostly about behavioral change of people in leadership roles. And that is the single thing to focus on. And few transformations focus on that. They're usually about creating new processes and stuff. The processes, the frameworks, don't matter because people will create the processes they need if the leaders are good. They'll figure out what processes that process. You need process. But you don't have to give them a process. You don't have to have some group define this is how everyone's going to do things. They will figure out what processes they need. That the processes come second, not first. You need to improve the leadership skill. They need knowledge too. They need knowledge of lean thinking and those kinds of things, because those are mental toolkits. But first and foremost, they need the behavioral change. You need to improve their EQ. Most people in leadership roles don't have leadership training. They don't, and they need to. And, you know, and it's more than a two-hour seminar. There's a lot to learn. We've identified that the applicable, you know, domains are leadership theory, behavioral psychology, cognitive science, operations research, and organizational culture theory. And people need to understand the key ideas in those fields in order to have the cognitive framework for how to think about what they're doing when they lead.
Sounds like a lot overlapped with the idea of an entrepreneur. Am I right?
Very much so. Entrepreneurial thinking is very important today among leaders in organizations. One of the common behaviors that we found in these highly agile companies was the expectation that people will try things before being sure. Instead of planning it all out and dotting every I until you're completely sure this is going to work, and then it probably won't because it's too late and people are sick of it and the details are not right. So you overplan and then you miss the window of opportunity. We found in these highly agile companies that the leaders are very proactive about insisting that people try things before being sure. They're proactive about that. Amazon has a rule of thumb, 70%. If you have 70% of the information you need to make a decision, you need to make the decision. Don't wait to have more information. 70% is enough. Make the decision. And in a safe way and contained way, and see what happens. SpaceX has a similar rule. If you're 51% sure it will work, you need to try it. Don't wait. Waiting is a lean waste. Don't ever wait. If you're 51% sure, that's good enough. Click print on the 3D printer to make the part, put it in the rocket engine, put it on the test stand, and see what happens and measure the heck out of it. So the leaders are very proactive about letting people know that the leaders expect that you won't wait, that you won't hesitate. Leaders generate the culture through articulating what they expect and then how they react to things.
I mean, there's a lot of risk tolerance, a lot of learning how to negotiate, of course, convincing people to follow your advice or in general, your leadership. It makes me think of an article, I don't remember the name, but it's really also overlapped with a lot of the work we do with the 3EO, an article from the HBR from many years ago, a couple of years ago. Essentially, they identified three types of leadership for adaptive organizations, and it was some kind of architectural leadership that is needed to set the rules of the organization. Then there was an enabling leadership, people that are more into supporting the others into these kind of hard journeys that you are highlighting as the future. And then, of course, there was entrepreneurial leadership. So the idea to bring things forward and take risk and understand customers' needs and listen and research and operational elements. This was a good framework for me. We didn't speak about much about the architectural side and the enabling side in the conversation, but I think we kind of gave them for granted that they were there. And in the system, now you have the entrepreneurial leader that extends and develops the organization in certain different directions.
You know, the whole architecture side.
The edgy, you mean the intersection group people.
Yeah, exactly. So he's very big on that, and he's right. Because that's kind of where agile and lean intersect. Depending on how you define lean, because what lean meant 30 years ago is like, today lean is everything. It's like all these paradigms, over time, they start accumulating everything that else. So now agile is everything and lean is everything. So the original lean, which was mainly about flow, except now flow is everything. But the original lean was more about sequential processes. But the lean was a set of ideas on how to make sequential processes very flexible and very self-correcting. And that enables agility, but it doesn't give you agility, because if you have those flexible infrastructure, flexible system, then the way you behave can use that to be very nimble. But if you have people who behave like just thinking incrementally, to be agile, you need to realize that you need to change the flow. Create a new flow. So if your behavior is just think incrementally, you'll just think how to tweak the flow. You won't think about, you know, that flow is not right. We need a new flow. Thinking about, you know, the mechanics and the flow and like edgy, the architecture. And I know he thinks of architecture in terms of people too. That's really important. It takes many kinds of leadership. Like Peter Drucker used to say, you need inside person, an outside person, and a person of action. The inside person is often like the CTO. It's someone who has great technical, probably, abilities, or it's someone who all the people inside relate to and respect. They kind of trust that person. That person often is the one who set up the flow, the original one. Now, is it agile? I don't know, but they did set up the original flow. And the outside person is the charismatic one. If you look at Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, they both wrote Good Will Hunting, but I have a feeling that Matt Damon really kind of was the deep thinker and Ben Affleck was kind of like wrote the exciting parts or something. Everybody wants to socialize with Ben Affleck, but Matt Damon like is a really nuanced, deep actor who can act any part. It's amazing. He's believable in comedies. He's believable in these dark dramas. So there's a real depth to him. And he's kind of like the inside person. Ben Affleck's the outside person, the charismatic CEO. But then the person of action is like Andy Grove at Intel. It's like, get shit done. Time is ticking and time matters. What's happening? Where are we? Not be mean about it, although a lot of them are mean about it. And I don't think that's great. But Andy Grove wasn't mean about it. He was actually a very nice guy. I mean, I didn't know him, but actually a colleague of mine did know him. But the reports are that I've seen is that he was a nice guy, but he invented OKRs. He was very much thinking about how to keep things moving, how to keep things aligned. And you need that too. Because in business, time matters. You cannot be hesitating. You need to be watching the clock.
I mean, I'm extremely curious to just see how all of this sort of integrates more and more as we go, right? I mean, even within our call today, we've spoken about so many different practices and how they have sort of combined together. So that's nice to hear. Just wanted to check in with you for our breadcrumbs, as we call it, at the closing of our podcast. So any movies, podcasts, videos, books that you might recommend for our listeners that, you know, has influenced you?
I didn't know ahead of time that you were going to ask for that, so I would have put a list together. But at top of mind, it's pretty easy. Two books I always recommend people are, one is Accelerate by Nicole Forrest Gren. I like that book because it documents some very thorough research that she did about the behavior of teams in high-tech companies. And she found that it wasn't servant leadership, it was transformational leadership that made teams effective. That's not to like dismiss servant leadership, because servant leadership is kind of an element of transformational leadership. It's a set of behaviors, and those are important behaviors, but that's not enough. Leading teams is more than that. Her research is very factual and concrete. Although I would caveat, she co-authored it with Gene Kim and Jez Humble, and lately Jez Humble has decided to promote the idea of what in programming is now called trunk-based development, as if that's the only way to do things. And it's not. it's not the only way or best way. It's a way, and it's a good way, but it depends. There are lots of situations where it's not the best way. So he's kind of very pedantic about that issue, which is mentioned in the book. But I highly recommend the book. It's a fantastic book. She actually, by the way, has a copy of the Agile 2 book. I've talked to her, and she she liked our book. Another is David Marquette, who wrote Turn the Ship Around. And he's a former submarine captain. He writes about how he was generative in converting his crew from being people who just take orders to people who think for themselves. He gave them problems to solve. And he taught them to think out loud instead of being tight-lipped and afraid to say what they really think. So he was a coach and a mentor also. And he also remained a decision maker. He didn't just stand back. He made decisions. Leaders don't abdicate. They're decisive. But they know when to let other people decide. And they prefer to do that. But they also know that time matters, and it's their job to make sure that things keep working. He also has a copy of the Agile 2 book, and I have a picture of him holding it. His book is fantastic. It's a great read. I highly recommend it. It's called Turn the Ship Around.
Thank you so much, Cliff. I mean, it was a long conversation, and this is really a thesis topic that it's dear to our listeners. This is something that we discuss very often, right? How do we evolve from old models that need to be reinvented, because the market now, the society now really demands different approaches, demands a different level of leadership and adaptability. So thank you so much for your time. I hope you also had good time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. And I'd just like to close with one thought.
Yeah.
It's not what you do, it's how you do it.
Yes, yes, yes. Again, we spoke about means and ends a lot of times. It's also a good way to kind of create a counterbalance, because sometimes also how you do things drives outcomes. So thank you so much. For our listeners, check out on our website www.boundaries.io/resources/podcast. You will find Cliff's episode with transcript, the video, and all the notes. And until we speak again, remember to think boundaryless.